The Psychedologist.
Dr. Sherry Walling is a clinical psychologist, speaker, podcaster, author, and mental health advocate. Her company, Zen Founder, helps entrepreneurs and leaders navigate transition, rapid growth, loss, and any manner of complex human experience. Sherry hosts the Zen Founder podcast, as well as Mind Curious, a podcast series exploring innovations in mental health care via psychedelics. Her new book, Touching Two Worlds, is a poetic, incisive exploration of grief and joy in the aftermath of loss. Her best-selling book, The Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together, combines the insight and warmth of a therapist with the truth-telling mirth of someone who has been there. Sherry and her husband, Rob, reside in Minneapolis, where they spend their time driving their children to music lessons. She has also been known to occasionally perform as a circus aerialist. And we talk about that a bit in this episode, as well as grief, prayer, religion, loss, pleasure and pain, love, parenthood, IFS, and movement. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to The Psychedologist, Sherry.
It's really great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to have you as a guest and just so appreciative of what your work is in this moment of this collective moment for humankind, as well as just this personal moment for myself. So thank you for bringing light to grief and grace to it.
It feels like this is a good moment for us to have a conversation.
Yes, always a good moment for that. Well, what was your relationship to consciousness as a child?
I was one of those, like, pretty serious children who thought a lot of big thoughts. I also grew up in a very evangelical family, in an evangelical community. My dad was a youth pastor. His dad was a Southern Baptist minister in the Midwest. And so there was a lot of like religious, spiritual conversation in my world as a child. And so I think I had this really deep desire to go deep, to understand like the nature of humanity, the nature of God, the nature of the world around me. So I think my framework of consciousness came very much from the religious tradition, especially as a youngster. And it wasn't until kind of my 20s that I kind of understood the nature of humanity aside from that tradition. But I kind of valued it when I was a kid. Like, I was glad that I grew up with this. There were things I didn't love about it. Let me be really clear. Like, it was not good for me as a girl. It was not good for me as a sexual being. It was not good for me in lots of ways. But it was good for me in my sense of, like, exploration of the other or the universe, or even a sense of prayer was a rich part of my life as, like, a seven-year-old, which I think was good for me. So,
I'm thinking of this word prayer. And I was in an ayahuasca ceremony this summer and they encouraged fasting. Mm. And I had always strayed from fasting. I didn't want to like trigger eating disorder thoughts or behaviors. But I was feeling really supported and a lot of trust in the container. And the space holder kept saying that the fasting is your prayer. You're in the prayer of fasting. Mm. And looking at it that way was my first time connecting to prayer in this meaningful way. So now anytime anyone said prayer before, I think I would be a little bit suspicious. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, oh, yes, prayer. I love it.
Like, I have this visceral download of prayer now. Yes.
Yeah.
I maybe similarly have been reading Gabrielle Roth's book, Sweat Your Prayers. She is the founder of the Five Rhythms Dance Method. And so talks a lot about this like transcendent communion that can come through movement. And I think that's what I think of as prayer. It's that sort of communication or intention or openness to something that's much bigger than yourself or your own consciousness. You're tapping into source or God. And the idea that that can come in these really embodied ways, whether that's through fasting or through dance or through any kind of like expression where you reach the end of yourself and what feels comfortable in you and tap into something bigger, it's a really beautiful experience.
Yeah. I recognize the name. Did she write Women, Food, and God too?
Maybe. I don't know. I could look
that was a really good, yeah. I can check it later. I'm not one of those bro podcasters that has like a little like Google it minion to like, Jamie, look that up.
Yeah, no, I don't have a minion. I just have another tab. But if I open another tab, I'm like distracted from you. So we'll just have to leave that for the like the show notes, the later conversation.
Yes, leave it for the show notes. Well, thank you for sharing about where you've come from. I'm amazed at how many people grew up in more, I don't know the way to say it, more orthodox or, you know, the more intense religious context, especially of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Major props for finding your way out of
surviving.
Something that, yeah, yes, surviving, yes. And facing the burning in hell or something kind of threats that you may have been told you would have to face if you strayed from what you're supposed to do. So that's very courageous to walk to your own truth.
Yeah, there are still people praying for me and my soul out of love, which is what I can hear it as now. I have such a like complicated relationship with religion as I'm, you know, who doesn't? Many people do. But there are many gifts in it and many, like I said, many things that I value and were good for me. And then many violences that I and my female body are still grappling with on every level of my consciousness, my conscious awareness, all the way down to the sort of intergenerational transmission of that violence. And so I think to have something that's capable of much good and much destruction, and then to have a lifelong ebb and flow with it, it's important to me, but it is something that, I feel like I've survived. Yeah.
Is that part of, part of the reason we're here is to talk about your book and your work. Yeah. Does that come into play in the grief work?
Yeah, I think all conversations about trauma and grief inevitably at some point tap into someone's set of beliefs or ways of understanding the world beyond them. So, you know, when people are in the midst of their deep trauma experiences, they're often calling for God, or they're calling for their mother, they're calling for a helping protector. And so whatever our conceptualization of God is, like there's something sort of visceral inside us that's sort of like, someone, something, somewhere, help me. So the trauma world is certainly really a place of a lot of like theological discussion about where the helper is when this horrible thing is happening. And then the grief world certainly taps into all kinds of questions and conversation around what is the nature of our existence and what happens after we die? Does anything happen? Do our bodies just get absorbed by the earth? And is there even in that some kind of sacred carrying forward of our life force? Or is there some external entity that is welcoming us to another iteration? And then, of course, the more traditional conceptualization of heaven as like a place where you go, where you get your assigned mansion after living a life in service to God. It sounds funny, but like that is absolutely what I grew up with, is like, you know, do well in this life and like you get a nice setup in the afterworld. And
I'm just so amused at like even the afterlife is capitalist.
Yes. There's relative like real estate. Yeah. Sad. So anyway, I don't get away from any of those conversations. They started when I was young and they've carried forward in every part of my work. Even though my relationship with traditional religion or affiliation with a certain church is very, very different than it was when I was a kiddo. It feels important to be comfortable there, right? To have like real honest regard for people's belief, even if it's really different than mine, and to be able to hold that space as they explore what does it mean if I die or someone I love dies, where do they go? How do I commune with them? How do I touch them? How do I make sense of this relationship that I feel with them, even though they're no longer physically present? So the sort of spirit world is really alive in the conversations around death.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah, I'm thinking of many things. One is my journey toward validating that there are many spiritual beliefs and that I do not need to decide which ones are right or think that mine are wrong if they're different than other people's. That there's more room for connection in our different beliefs than for disconnection. And then about death specifically, I'm thinking about Daniel 4. He and Bayo Akomolafe, there's like a talk online called Decolonizing the Dead, which Laura May Northrup suggested to me. And I'll put that link in the show notes. One thing that was said in the talk was that rites, funerary rites or, you know, rituals after the passing of someone are more for the living than they are for the dead these days. And that was like something to be aware of and maybe something that could be problematic. But I think that it is important for the living to have those rituals and that connection, and it may look many different ways for many different people. But for it to be named that, like, this is for the living, I guess, and this is for the dead, like, who is it for? And that's more clear.
To be clear about the intention. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's so, it's a truth telling, right? We think we're having a memorial service to honor the one who's lost, but really we're having it for us. And that's perfectly fine. That's totally okay. We get to honor our sense of lostness or pain by gathering our community and saying, come and eat with me. Come and share stories about the person that I've loved that I no longer have access to. And that's a very good reason to gather the folks. But it isn't necessarily for the spirit of the one that's departed. Yeah, that conversation has so many sort of depths and complexities based in how we believe and where we've come from about what is necessary and what even we think happens after a body takes its last breath. I lost my brother to suicide a couple of years ago, and some of what I write about in the book is just my sense of connection to his body and the trauma for me of him dying far away from me. A few months before he died, I lost my dad to cancer, and I was in the bed with my dad. So I was with his body as he transitioned over, and it had a very different feeling, sort of this feeling of completion. Not that I wasn't sad and all those things, but like to be with his body and care for it as he was approaching death was sacred work and felt so much like I felt when I was caring for my infant children, you know, attending to their breath and washing their bodies, and everything is very gentle and tender because they're so fragile. So that felt this very full circle kind of feeling to be able to be with my dad in that moment. And the contrast with my brother's body dying in a violent way, dying far away from any touch or comfort or caretaking, that grief felt very different. And so with my brother's ashes, our family gathered. We didn't have any kind of service formally, but our family gathered and we all held his ashes in our hands, including my young children who were at the time were eight. The youngest was eight. And we paddled out to the middle of this lake that my brother loved and released his ashes into that lake. And everyone in our family that was still alive, the remaining crew, had this really intimate contact with the remnants of his body and then released them to the water. And I don't know where that action lies in the history of how people grieve their dead bodies and their loved ones. But I know that for me, it was my best homage of returning his body to a place of peace for what was available to me, what action I could take. And that felt so important with his body in a very different way than it felt with my dad's body.
Yeah. I'm really just hit with emotion right now for what that must have been like for you.
Yeah. In many ways, I think my psychedelic work prepared me for that moment because it was in that work, most probably especially working with mushrooms, that you feel that sort of mycelium-based connection to the underworld, to the earth below the surface, where things decay and then become reabsorbed by the world, by the earth. And it was in some of those scenes in psychedelic work that I felt a communion with his body in a way that I felt like I could help release it back in this very deep way. I don't know that I would have known how to, I might have had a thought about it, but not a deep knowing in my body, not a sacred knowing, had I not been able to do some of that work.
Yeah. One thing I feel curious about is, I think it's a two-part question. What have you learned from being so close in such proximity to two deaths, but very different deaths, right? Mm-hmm. And in one, you weren't physically proximal, but it was your brother. So what have you learned from being in those? And then the second part is from writing about it, from, I'm sure, talking about it many times and doing interviews and whatnot, does that change the experience? Like, does it make it less powerful, you know, the insights? Because I know the more I talk about my trips, they can become more trite, but I could see it also getting processed in a different way from talking about it a lot as well. So just curious about what you've learned and how the experience has been to just be so public about it.
Yeah. I'll answer, I guess, the second part first. And I think for me, it's felt really important to kind of leave like a hand-drawn map. And I say this because I'm 44. My birthday's tomorrow. I'm turning 44. And so I'm in middle adulthood. I'm a little bit on the younger side for people to lose their parents. I certainly have a number of friends who've lost their parents, but you know, fast forward 10 years, it will be a very common experience among everyone in my peer group that we will be caring for and saying goodbye to our parents. And we'll be entering that season of everyone going to funerals, where earlier in our lives, we had a season of all going to weddings and then baby showers and then, you know, whatever, just doing this generational thing. And so I'm a little bit on the early side from my generation. And I watched my brother so implode after the loss of our dad. He wasn't great before, but he really imploded. And I want, it feels so important to me to like leave any little traces of helpful notes and tidbits just in case it helps steady someone else who feels that unsteadiness after the loss of a parent or anybody who is really close to them. So I don't mind talking about it. It's important for me to talk about it. It hasn't yet gotten to a place where it feels like rote. You know, there are other parts of my work where I've got talking points, I've got it down, I use the same language. It's, you know, it's my job as a teacher and sort of public person. But this hasn't yet started to feel like that. It still feels like every time I talk about it, it just goes right to my belly and it's raw and real. So that keeps it precious, if that makes sense. I imagine that I won't always be telling these stories in this way because it, you know, my focus will move on to other things. But for right now, it feels so precious and important to be able to talk about these things. You asked what I've learned. I really have this deep sense of the importance of grief, of grieving, of it being not unlike love as one of these like fundamental core parts of the human experience. And I feel like it's something that culturally, at least in many of the circles I run in, people just graze right through. It's, you know, there's all this language around, oh, I knew it was happening. They're in a better place. It's just, we just suppress and repress and move on in a way that we miss all of this like juicy goodness about how to love and what it means to show up in life in pain and what it means to love someone who's not here anymore. I think grief is really important. And that's maybe just the like biggest, highest level lesson is to sort of invite people toward it, into it, not the belief that we should be able to handle that. It's all okay.
Could I read you the full quote I was mentioning before we recorded of what a friend just sent me about grief this morning?
I would love that.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to know your opinion on it. It's from Jamie Anderson at Healing Intimacy. And it says, "Grief, I've learned, is really just love. It's all the love you want to give, but cannot. All of that unspent love gathers up in the corners of your eyes, the lump in your throat, and in that hollow part of your chest. Grief is just love with no place to go."
I don't know how you can take apart love and grief. Like, they are the same. They are interwoven. And you only feel grief when there's been a sense of love. And I think what's new to me is this piece about grief is this love that's longing for expression, longing for a place to land, and doesn't have a landing spot in this world, in this current reality. So that resonates as really true to me. Very true. And that's why I do feel like grief is so precious. It's not brokenness. It's not depression. It's not sadness. Not that depression and sadness are brokenness, but it's just, it's a really deep expression of the pure longing for the presence of another. And I think it's really important. I love that quote.
So I see in the background, I think that's your book right there, isn't it?
It is my book right here. Yep.
Can you talk about how you came to the title?
Yeah. So the book is called Touching Two Worlds. And it is my reflection on what it felt like for me in my, you know, early 40s, right around turning 40, to be totally immersed in this world of people that I love getting getting sick and dying. You know, my dad had 18 months from when he was diagnosed to when he died. And really, my brother's implosion followed a very similar timeline. So there was sort of this two-year period where these two people I love were just falling apart. And then they died. And then we were left with this huge hole. So I was in this world of death and sickness. And then on the other side, I was in this other world of like giving, you know, life and energy to beautiful children, of building my own career, of living very much in an aliveness that I really valued and cherished. And so I found myself like shifting back and forth between these two worlds and being like, is this normal? Like, do people do this? And the reality is that yes, like I, you know, we can live in these multiple worlds at the same time. And I think it became really important for me to embrace that both could be true at once, that I could fully immerse in this darkness and find all of the value in it and not be afraid of it and not believe that it would threaten to overtake the other part of my life. Because I could sort of have a passport to go back and forth. And many days I did. Many days I would sort of sit with my dad in chemo and be witness and present to his dying. And then other, you know, 2 hours later, I'm at a school play where kids are like covered in glitter and wearing funny crowns. And it's like, whew, how do I contain all of it? And the answer is you don't. You just move back and forth. So that's the title. And kind of the premise, really, of how you find that passport that takes you back and forth between those worlds.
Those two worlds and their back-to-backness in the way that your life was, that reminds me a lot of psychedelic journeying, right?
Yeah.
You know, the horror and the humor, and they're right next to each other. And maybe they're in one, like, oh, ineffable.
Well, the beauty of psychedelics is it sort of takes you out of linear time, which is really helpful, right? The sense that, like, it's not sequential, that you're in both at one time. That's a helpful lesson for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is calling to mind something else from that ayahuasca retreat this mm-hmm. summer. I don't think I've spoken about this publicly, but without giving the whole lead up part of the story, ayahuasca was telling me, or I was seeing, that I can help other people hold their pain and that this is a gift. And it's sort of, it's like almost a mission of almost like why I'm here. I was sort of asking, not why am I here, but I was asking like, who am I? And part of that, who am I, was like, who am I? I know I'm not just here to help other people. Like, that's part of what I do, but I want to know who I am. Mm-hmm. And instead, I was just getting all about who I am to other people and that is part of who I am. And so I was like, okay. And the first thing that struck me was what a gift it is to be able to help people hold their pain. And I felt moved by, yeah, the honor of having that ability to do something precious like that. And then I thought, well, what about me? What about my pain? That was the question mm-hmm. I asked. And then in the sort of circuitous, non-direct way that medicine can answer, I was told, if you focus on pleasure and feeling more pleasure and experiencing more joy and delight, like at every possible chance, like if you orient to pleasure, you'll be able to hold so much more pain. So
I love that.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm really integrating it the best yet, but because it's hard. It's a hard
shift. You didn't figure that out right away? Because it's total reorientation.
Yeah.
I had this big experience the day that I found out my brother died, which was my body, upon hearing this news, really, I felt like I was struck by lightning. This was not a psychedelic journey. This was, you know, in this linear time. And I fell on the ground, like many people do after a trauma. And I had these two urges. And one was to, like, tear shit apart, like, to destroy something, to throw something, to claw at my own body, just to, like, really violently break apart. And then at the same time, I had this other urge that was like, I want to make love. I want to have sex. I want to be in the full expression of pleasure in my body. And it was a really powerful, like, moment. And I think about the, like, the need to grow a container that was big enough to hold both. But part of my, like, post-grief, post-death story is similar to what you're saying. It is this, like, deep commitment to pleasure, to fully understanding or fully exploring the full range of what delight and joy and bliss and sensuality. Because all of those things are aliveness, right? They're the source, the spark of life. Even on the, like, sort of visceral sexual level, it's in that pleasure that life is born, that life comes from. And so I felt like one of the things that has most sustained me through holding my own pain and then feeling like I could hold other pain was that moment of lightning shooting through me. And this, like, deep knowing of follow the pleasure. So I'm really grateful for the share that you just offered, because there's a big parallel for me in that need to combine pain and pleasure, or to hold pleasure as a way to offset or counterbalance or just create maybe more space for the capacity to hold pain and enter pain. It was a weird experience, not gonna lie. I was like, my brother just died. Why do I want to have sex with something? Like, what's wrong with me?
I get that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I've since, I wrote about it in the book, so I've since had lots of people sort of share similar moments. And, you know, people can think what they think about Freud, and lots of stuff was super messed up there, but, like, he did talk about those deep drives of thanatos and libido and how those are some of the core drivers of human experience. And of course, thanatos is the drive towards death and destruction. And libido is the drive towards creation, construction, making, sex. And that we're always holding those drives inside of us. And I think when you have a trauma or a major loss, or an ayahuasca, you know, those things crack open the structures that keep those things inside, and they get released in a different way. So blessings on the pleasure journey.
We'll have to circle back around next year.
Yes.
So
have a date next summer.
Yeah. Pleasure check-in. As you were talking, I don't know what it was, but something made me want to ask you about guilt and where does guilt live in all this? And as I thought to ask that, and then I was like, why am I thinking about guilt? I realized I feel guilty to seek pleasure sometimes. Mm. And then I wondered, does my guilt interfere with feeling the grief that I need to feel? Like, is guilt, because I think it does. I think that feeling guilty in some way makes me focus on myself and I don't grieve. Yeah, so I don't know. Any thoughts about guilt?
Yeah, so it's really, It's impossible to, well, I won't make a grand statement about it. I will just speak about my own experience. Suicide is really, really tied in with guilt for many people. And I don't know anybody who has lost someone they love in that way who hasn't done the mental math of like, what if I'd done this or said that, or I could have known that in this moment, I would have acted differently, you know, just does the deconstruction into how did I have a part in this and how could I have acted differently for a different outcome. So that's it's big work, and I won't say that I have it all figured out. As I'm talking about it, I hear my voice tightening. So I know you asked about guilt and pleasure, but I think there's deep guilt around still being alive when I wasn't able to help with so much suffering. That's also messy for me as a psychologist, right? I'm a mental health professional. I know how to save people from suicide, air quotes. So there's ways that I have come to a deep sense of okayness with that conversation. I won't say it's like all wrapped up neatly in a bow, but some of the okayness comes from this sense that there were things that I did in the ways that I loved my brother that were absolutely perfect. You know, that I showed up with big love over and over again. And there were things that I did that were not awesome. And that's sort of true of every relationship I've ever had and will probably be true of every relationship. So it's just true of me. And I
can say that sounds like me too.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for joining in that humanness. But I think that the desire is to be free enough from that guilt to feel like I can be fully present in my life. And so in a way, it is the grappling with guilt over that death that has helped me find a new sense of openness to my own pleasure. Because the other story, of course, is that growing up as a church kid, as a girl, there's all kinds of like loading around bodies and pleasure and guilt and the purpose, you know, like none of that really. You're supposed to not have a body and definitely not like it and definitely not do anything fun with it. So anyway, I guess it all comes full circle. But guilt has been something so deep for me to grapple with in the context of grief that doing that work has had this wonderful byproduct, I think, of helping me to heal some of those early guilt and shame stories that would have in the past impeded my ability to really experience pleasure. I don't know if that's helpful, but sort of like I've been to the Guilt World series. So... it's interesting, yeah. Too. I mean, I've been married for a long time, and my husband's been, you know, had a front row seat to all this stuff, and it's really shaped in some ways our relationship, the way that we operate, the assumptions of our marriage, and in ways that have been really beautiful. So there's been some, again, this sort of unexpected aliveness on the other side of deep grief.
Yeah. I'm glad that you had his support and presence. I guess I'm assuming that you had his support, his witnessing.
His witnessing. I mean, there were years in the middle of all of this where his job was to manage our children and our family, and my job was to help with the hurting, dying people. So it was sort of these years of separation where we weren't separated and we didn't break up, but we were like doing very different things in the world. And it was on the other side of some of that that we've been able to come back together and kind of reconstruct a new version of the relationship. But the truth of it is like, it was sort of this like 3-year separation. It just was never official. It was never articulated. Which grief is very, I mean, I think deep grief does that to a lot of people, right? It takes your life force. It diverts your attention. It takes your focus. And the relationships that you were in prior to it don't fit. They don't work given the new conditions or the new assumptions of your life. So the relationships often fail, or they have to be rebuilt. And thankfully ours was the latter experience, but I mean, lots of psychedelic help there.
They're good for so many things.
So many things.
I think I have one last question, but room for it to go lots of different ways. Before we hit record, we talked about internal family systems for like a second. Mm. And I just wonder, because I have been struck by the accessibility of this framework. And I think in that way a lot. And I work with clients in that way a lot now. Is there anything you'd like to say about IFS and you and professionally or personally? Really open-ended.
Yeah. Well, I'll just echo your sense that it's really accessible. And I think it gives us a really nice, neutral way to talk about inner conflict without villainizing anything, right? Without villainizing parts of ourselves. And I was, you know, as we were talking before recording, this grief work has led me to a place, you know, there's a part of me that's like in this healer mode, but it's a healer with a lot of capacity for darkness. It's very serious. It's holding a lot of that pain, as you described. And as that part of me has become so deep and taken up so much space, I've also felt this like more childlike, I need to play, I need to dance, I need to get my feet in the grass. And that childlike part of me has gone on a very deep and extensive relationship with aerial arts. So I basically joined the circus at the same time as I'm doing all this really deep grief stuff. So flying on the trapeze and being in aerial fabrics and spinning around and dropping, and it's like a giant jungle gym.
Yeah.
And so that childlike part has all this big life, but it feels like they're a pair. They have to go together. And then I was telling you, there's this like stern mother in me who's like, whoa, Sherry, like a lot of energy is going on here. Like, should you maybe just sit down and drink some water and like be still? So there's the protectress there who's like, careful, honey, careful. Like, don't fly too high. Don't go too deep. Like, know your way to the middle space. So it's funny to observe how those different parts take on new life and new shape through these different iterations of our lives. So as a mother, my children are really getting a kick out of this like childlike part. My kids are teenagers now. And I do a little performing and blah, 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 but like, you know, I've got costumes, there's outfits, there's glitter, it's silly. And they're like, Mom, are you wearing that for sure? And I'm like, I'm totally wearing this, guys. And they're like, okay, go get it, Mom. So it's a fun dynamic to have be part of our lives. My kids also read my book. And the book is very, you know, it's pretty raw. It's pretty heavy. They read all about some of my psychedelic experiences. They have been in this story, but then now they've read it from my perspective, which I guess I'm getting off from your IFS journey. But again, that sense of like my literal children are interacting with these different parts of my internal construction. And that's been really interesting to watch and reflect on. mostly like very cool. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm seeing your children playing with your inner children, or right, this like relationship that's possible between our exiles and the living children in our life.
Yeah. And what a delight. I mean, it's good. Like, it's good. It's good for parents, for me to be able to get down and play in that way. I think it's very life affirming for the kids. I think it is very life affirming for me to let that part flourish and not feel stuck in some, you know, standard of how I am to behave as this external construction of who I am, right? Like, you're a 40-year-old person with a PhD, like, you know, like, back off the glitter, lady. And no, I refuse to. And my kids are all about it, which is great. So.
Well, aerial arts sounds like a, like, epic consciousness hack. I'm curious if if there's anything else that you want to speak to that you use to connect with yourself and your consciousness these days.
I think that is the other huge lesson of grief, is the embodied nature of it. So the aerial journey, a journey with dance. I feel like anyone who's holding grief, one of the most powerful tools to wield the depth of it is in movement, whether that's just walking or swimming or, you know, being really embodied, I think is a gift of a way to tap into the aliveness that wants to come out of a recognition of loss. So that's been super profound for me. It's also reconnected me to my love for words, you know, which is a little bit weird, but like, it's in my movement that words find their way to me. And so my life as a writer has taken on new life because I've given such big expression to the feelings that are inside of me. So, you know, sometimes in a psychedelic journey, one of the things that a guide may say is like, do you want to make it bigger? Make it bigger, like give full expression. You can yell, you can cry, you can hit that pillow, you can throw that thing, like make it bigger. I feel like in a way that's kind of this journey that I've been on in my walking around life, and that making it bigger has led to this sense of expression that has come out in this book. And it's a book I'm really proud of. Like, it feels like some of the great work of my life is in these pages to help tell these stories in a way that is accessible to people's hearts, I hope.
Well, where can people find you, find your book to keep following along? You have so much to offer, and I'm just so grateful for your voice on here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I live on the internet as at Sherry Walling on Instagram and Twitter. And the book is called Touching Two Worlds, and it's available kind of wherever. It's in your local neighborhood bookstore. It's on Amazon, you know, wherever you find books, it should be there. And I have the website touchingtwoworlds.com kind of tells some of the backstory around the nature of the book. It also has some beautiful video of the circus show that I wrote about the book. Wow. Yeah, my publisher just like their head almost blew up. But we created an original circus for Mental Health Awareness Month in May that was all about using movement to cope with loss by suicide. It was actually a spectacular evening. So yes, all of that is available on the internet, and I love, you know, connecting and sharing stories. So please reach out.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Psychedologist is Consciousness Positive Radio. Find us everywhere podcasts are hosted. For more information, visit us on Facebook or online at thepsychedologist.com. Thank you.